This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm Jed Lipinski. In Gone South Season 4, we'll be bringing you new stories every week with no end in sight. Listen to and follow Gone South, an Odyssey original podcast, on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, folks. We are joined by the Louisiana Secretary of State, Nancy Landry. She is responsible for our election system in the state of Louisiana. A number of laws were changed in the last legislative session, and things may appear a little different when you go to vote, or maybe not. And she's here to talk to us about that. Nancy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Newell. Thanks for having me on. Thank you for having me on today. I'm sorry my voice is a little bit under the weather.
Well, we hope that you get better soon. What can folks expect on November 5th when they go to vote? Will there be any apparent changes?
I don't think anybody will notice anything differently. Most of our changes were common sense changes to the law that closed some loopholes regarding absentee ballot harvesting and cleaning up our voter rolls and making sure that absentee ballots are counted consistently throughout the state. And so I think on Election Day, people will not notice any difference at all. We're ready for Election Day, and it should be just, business as usual.
A lot of folks don't understand the importance of the voter rolls being sacrosanct, right? As we do mail-in votes and other options that have been available, if you're sick or ill, infirm, serving overseas, it's important that the voter rolls stay current, right?
That's correct, and it's also required under federal law as well. And so we do what's called an annual canvass, where we send a letter asking for verification of address to voters who have filed a change of address card with the Postal Service. And in this past session, a new law was passed that will allow us to also verify voters who haven't voted in 10 or more years. So we'll be doing that additional canvass next year, and that'll allow us to verify even more voters on our voter rolls and keep them even cleaner than we normally do.
There were a lot of folks that I think at one point in time there was an interest in doing a biannual canvass. What was the opposition to that?
Do you mean twice a year by biannual?
Yes, ma'am. Yeah.
Yeah, we're limited in when we can do it because it can't occur during certain time frames before an election. Louisiana has so many elections that might have been the time constraint, but I don't recall that effort to do it twice a year. We do it annually, and now we will be doing both of these canvasses at the same time. And maybe that's what it was when we first proposed this bill. When Les Farnham first filed this bill, it was going to be an additional canvas. And since working with the legislature, we came up with the plan to do it all at the same time so as to not inconvenience the registrars as much and the voters as much.
And obviously, you work with the local registrar of voters offices throughout the state of Louisiana. If you would, describe the level of cooperation thus far in conducting the annual canvass.
Sure. Well, our local registrars of voters and our clerks of court in the parishes are our local election partners, and they're very important in putting on the elections, as well as all of our commissioners who work the elections. We couldn't put on elections without the help of our local partners and the people who work as commissioners of elections. We always need more people to do that. We have an elderly group of people, and many of them are deciding to retire. And so if anybody is interested in learning more about elections and in serving their community, you can sign up to be an elections commissioner. You just have to take a short training course and put, you know, ask the clerk of court in your parish, your local clerk of court is who hires the elections commissioners. And it's a great way to make a little bit of money right before Christmas as well.
Yeah, we did a public service for John Gegenheimer's office because he said he was down a little bit. And I think they were able to fill the complement necessary. I did get a text.
I met with him this morning.
Okay, go ahead.
He's been going around the state meeting with clerks of court and registrars of voters, asking them, you know, if there's any questions ahead of the elections, making sure everybody's ready. And we met with the clerk of court and the registrar in Jefferson Parish this morning. We're meeting with the Orleans Parish clerk of court this afternoon. And so we've been going around the state doing that, and it's been a great tour. We're visiting the warehouses where our equipment is stored, and we're just keeping our ear to the ground and making sure that we're ready to keep our elections safe and secure and accurate.
Absolutely. In our system, you know, there are a lot of systems that rely on some advanced technologies that could be hacked if not dealt with appropriately. What is this kind of the state of our system?
So our equipment, the election day equipment was manufactured in the early 90s, and it is not even capable of being connected to the internet. None of our equipment is ever connected to the internet, despite what you might hear. And so it's you know, extremely unlikely. And it's not just the equipment. It is all of the other things surrounding our election system. And we call it the four P's of election security, and it's our people, our policies and procedures, and our physical security of our election equipment. And those things all work together to protect our elections. We're ranked in the top 10 in the nation in election integrity. We have a lot to be proud of here in Louisiana. But our people are our local elections partners that we mentioned, the registrars of voters and the clerks of court, and only our trained Secretary of State technicians program our machines or do any maintenance on our machines. And when they're not in use, they're kept under lock and key. And like I said, never connected to the internet. That's the physical security part of it. And then the policies and procedures include our voter ID laws, our anti-ballot harvesting laws, and we test and seal our machines with a tamper evidence seal in a public meeting before every election.
There's a lot of hoopla about voter ID laws. Do y'all have many complaints about folks not being able to vote because they don't have an ID that's acceptable under the law?
You know, Newell, I've worked early voting several times, and I have never heard anyone complain about having to show an ID. I think, you know, it's something that is generally accepted, and I've never heard anyone complain about it. And so I'd always scratch my head when I hear people complaining about it. It just makes sense. We have to have an ID to do almost everything in our society. And so to do something as important, where your identity is so important as vote in an election, it just makes sense that you would need to have some, you know, identification to prove your identity.
Yeah, I was mystified by the most recent actions of Governor Gavin Newsom in California suspending the requirement to have to present an ID when going to vote in California. I got to imagine that it just opens yourself up to some potential abuse and fraud, right?
I would think so. I mean, I think you're just opening the door to fraud, especially if you're, you know, you're banning it. It's just, it just makes sense to check people's identity before they vote. It's a privilege and a right afforded to only U.S. citizens in Louisiana. And we want to make sure you are who you are presenting yourself to be before you vote.
Because as I recall, the role that the poll workers have really don't have a whole lot of demographic information about the potential voter in front of them, right?
They just, you know, have the name and the address, and I'm not really sure what else is on the poll book, but they do check the name and look at the picture on the ID and have the voter sign as well in the poll book.
But what I'm saying is that in these states, they're very similar to ours. There's just not a lot of demographic information. So if you go up and it says, you know, you have a name that's kind of nondescript, whether it's kind of not gender specific, you could claim to be anybody and just walk in and vote. No one would know the better.
I suppose that could happen.
Yeah.
And they're just opening the door to that, you know, to that happening more frequently with, you know, banning check-in and announcing that they're not going to be checking.
And it's really interesting because the states that have some of the most liberal policies about voting, even being able to register to vote on the day of the election and accommodating those folks to vote, in almost every case, those secretary of states or the individuals that are responsible for elections all talk about the sanctity of the voter rolls as being the key ingredient to preventing fraud and abuse.
Exactly. And how do you know that that's the person on the roll if you're not checking their identity? And so it's just a common sense requirement in Louisiana. Most voters agree and are in favor of having a voter ID when you go to vote. And so, you know, we're glad we have that in place here. And we're, you know, going to enforce that on Election Day.
A text came in asking, is a passport an acceptable voter ID?
It is. A passport is a, you know, a valid ID, and you can use that both to register to vote and to vote.
Another text came in saying, my mom died last year. Is there a mechanism for removing someone's name from the voting rolls?
There is. We ask that you contact the registrar in writing, either by an email or, you know, somehow to document that you're requesting the removal. They will investigate and look online for an obituary to confirm that before they remove someone, though. We have to match certain data points and follow the law before, you know, that can be confirmed and they can be removed from it. But once we confirm the death, we can. And we get that information from the health department regularly, I think twice a month. And we, you know, our registrars do work those lists and check and remove voters who have passed away.
Got a text earlier, folks asking about whether or not they are still able to become poll watchers and if there's a process still in place to do so.
I'm not sure the deadline for poll watchers. We in Louisiana have poll watchers that are for candidates, so that you could contact a candidate if you'd like to be a poll watcher for that candidate. And this is a new law that we have now, is to allow poll watchers for parties. So a recognized party in Louisiana can have a poll watcher. But we encourage people who want to observe elections to also consider working as an elections commissioner, because we need the help. And you can also observe the election while you're working and helping your community and helping your fellow voters to put on the election, because we need the help of the public. We have thousands of commissioners that we hire for every election, and we can't put on the election without them. So if we encourage people, you know, to work as a commissioner And if, you know, if they don't want to do that, being a poll watcher is fine, but you learn a lot just as much. You can observe just as much and also help out if you work as a election commissioner, and you can make some money.
Absolutely. Nancy, I think I've dealt with a number of the urban myths that I'm aware of. Are there any others that we need to correct folks on about? Because there is a lot of misinformation about some of the bills that passed and what the implications would be. Any others that you hear about?
We ask people to we encourage them to get their information from trusted sources, either from the Secretary of State or the Clerk of Court or the Registrar of Voters, not just about new legislation, but also about elections and where, when, and how to vote. And we encourage people to get our award-winning app. It's the Go Vote app, G-E-A-U-X, Vote. And it's a great app. It gives you your sample ballot, tells you where to vote, where to early vote, and just, you know, lots of great information on it. It's very easy to use. And so we get a lot of positive feedback about that. You can find out almost all the information you need on deadlines and where to vote on our app. But you can also go to our website and get it there. So we just encourage you to contact either the Secretary of State, the Clerk of Court, or the Registrar to get accurate information.
I did have one more text come in, and I think it's relevant. During the course of the recall election of Mayor LaToya Cantrell, there were some numbers that were bandied about relative to the active voter rolls being out of compliance by maybe as much as 20%. Do we know what the state of the voter rolls are in the city of New Orleans as of today?
We did have a list given to us that was part of that lawsuit, and we did work that list and find that 99% of the names that were alleged on that list to not be valid voters were in fact valid voters, and the ones that were not, we challenged them, and if they could not answer our challenge, they were put on the inactive list in accordance with law. So we work any list that anyone gives us any time we have reason to believe that someone is not a valid voter on the voter rolls. We always work that list, but we did have some legislation in the last session by Representative Les Farnham that's really going to help us keep our voter rolls clean. We're very excited about it. And it will allow us to like we said before, send a verification letter to voters who have not voted in over 10 years, 10 or more years. And we think that's going to really help us clean up our voter rolls a lot.
Absolutely. Final thoughts?
I just want to remind everybody about our deadlines. The last day to change your voter registration or to register to vote is October 15th. And at this point, you have to do it online because the deadline to do it in person has passed. So October 15th is the deadline to change your registration or to register to vote for the November 5th election. And early voting starts October 18th and goes through the 29th. We have 10 days of early voting for presidential. So the 18th through the 29th, but not on Sundays. And, of course, the election day is November 5th.
All righty. Well, thank you so much for joining us and providing that pertinent information. We truly appreciate it, and we hope that you are feeling better very soon.
Thank you. Thank you, Newell. Right. I appreciate it. All right.
Thank you. Nancy Landry, Louisiana Secretary of State, folks. We will be right back after the break. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line.
I'm Jed Lipinski. In Gone South Season 4, we'll be bringing you new stories every week with no end in sight. Listen to and follow Gone South, an Odyssey original podcast, on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Stay with us. Back, folks, one of the policy positions that Donald Trump is advocating for is the elimination of the Federal Department of Education. And we wanted an opportunity to talk about that proposition, both the upside and the downside. And joining us is J. Celeste Lay, professor of Department of Political Science at Tulane University. Jay, welcome to the show.
Thanks. You can call me Celeste.
Celeste, excuse me. I'm sorry. I apologize. All right. So, Celeste, okay. Kind of an interesting proposition. You don't hear very often about the elimination of a department at the federal level, albeit this department is not nearly as big as most others, about $238 billion in their budget. And about $175 billion of that amount is federal student aid. Your thoughts about what it is that this federal department actually does for states across the nation?
Sure. Well, thanks for having me on. Yeah, like you said, it's not the Department of Education is not as big as, say, the Department of Defense, you know, which has a nearly $2 trillion budget. And it's one of the newer departments created by President Carter in the late 70s. But in terms of what it does, like you said, one of its biggest programs or its biggest program is federal student loans for college. And then beyond the funding of college, one of the things that it funds is K through 12 programs that are targeted for students in poor school districts or students with disabilities.
Right.
Those programs sort of actually came before the Department of Education. So they, you know, didn't come about with the creation of the Department of Education, but they provide a great deal of funding for about $27 billion on elementary and secondary education. And then about $15 billion on special education to the states.
But why the necessity of the department, though? I mean, it seems to me that in some respect, and I was reading about it in preparation for this, that, you know, one of the primary motivations, they said, was to deal with, you know, whether or not school systems were appropriately implementing certain types of policies and whether or not, you know, the policy violated the Constitution or otherwise, whether they were unconstitutional, whether they were discriminatory in nature or otherwise. But the reality is a Department of Justice is the agency that actually conducts and manages those investigations and decides one way or another whether or not they're going to go after a state school system or a local school system. Why not just move to a block grant situation with states and let the states decide the best way to spend all of these dollars when you go through a lot of what they provide for and just remove and get this bureaucracy kind of off the federal budget?
Well, I think the rationale for a department is that these programs could be administered by different departments, like you said, the Department of Justice, or you know, the it used to be called the Housing and Urban Development. You know, there are various other agencies that could run these programs. The problem with that is that you're going to actually duplicate some funding and expertise and some resources, and so centralizing the programs into a single department actually probably saves money in terms of the administration of these programs. And so that was sort of the part of the essence of creating the department, is that over the course of 20 or 30 years, the federal government had created these various education-related programs, you know, not just K through 12, but higher ed and some other programs as well. And that they were being administered in other agencies. But because they weren't centralized, they were, you know, duplicative in some ways, and that this actually streamlines and saves the government money. Now, it's a slightly different question about sort of a block grant and putting, you know, giving the states that flexibility. If you're talking about K through 12 education, the amount of money and the percentage of sort of overall funding for K through 12 education, the amount from the federal government is very, very small. And so about 10% of K through 12 funding is from the federal government. So already states and local school districts are managing about 90% of the funding for K through 12 schools. So, you know, that's kind of already happening in terms of sort of who's in control and who can decide sort of whether to spend more money on teachers or more money on, you know, books or whatever that might be. But that's not a federal government decision to make under our current policy, or ever, really. So, you know, we do a lot of things through block grants, but this is already a program where the vast majority of this is already funded at the local level, and decisions are made by those at the state and local level about how that funding is allocated.
But there is this kind of phenomenon, right, with new administrations coming in and having these ideological conditions that are placed on a lot of this money, and, you know, trying to influence some change here, there, otherwise. We have a lot of friction between states and the federal government as to how best to spend these dollars in the present landscape. When we look at the amount of money that we spend in this country for education, I think we're the second highest in the world. Our outcomes are in the bottom third, and we're actually in the bottom of that bottom third. And, you know, we begin to wonder about whether or not it's time for us to kind of reimagine, re-engineer how we're going about doing that. I mean, and, you know, and I think one of the key examples, it was just reported on this morning. You have Democratic Senator John Tester up in Montana complaining about the Federal Department of Education with this one-size-fits-all policy that they're trying to implement relative to DEI goals, and whether or not that they were given the opportunity to make their case, and complaining about prioritizing diversity over merit. And it seems like we're getting caught up in this morass of these ideological wars, and meanwhile, our outcomes are abysmal.
Well, you know, you're right in terms of the test score outcome data that, you know, the United States is not near the top in, you know, of a variety of different tests. You know, in terms of kind of transitioning to a different way of doing education, if we were to do that, it would actually be, you know, a different way of doing things would be to give the federal government more authority, because the federal government has not historically had much to do at all with K through 12 education. So in terms of these mandates and kind of these culture war kind of issues around DEI or, you know, book banning and these sorts of things, again, most of these kinds of policies are passed at the state and local level. To the extent that the Federal Department of Education gets involved, there is a small office of civil rights within the Department of Education. And, you know, the need for that comes out of sort of a history of K through 12 education in the United States in terms of states denying funds to school districts that were predominantly Black, and, you know, other historical discrimination of various groups, and the federal government kind of taking that authority to ensure equality of opportunity. I mean, that's where these programs that come out of the Department of Education come from, is this American desire for and support for equality of opportunity. You know, we have a strong belief that we can tolerate differences in income, even large differences in income, very, very rich and very, very poor in terms of outcomes, if we fundamentally have a society where everybody kind of has an equal shot at success. Because then if we have equality of opportunity, then any differences are due to effort or hard work or good ideas or whatever it might be, and not sort of systemic discrimination. And these programs that were put in place to help fund poor school districts and students with disabilities, that's the impetus for those programs. And to administer them federally is to ensure that states and localities, which have historically done a lot of the discriminating, aren't in a position to be able to do that, so that that we get closer to a situation where we have equality of opportunity. I think most anybody that works in education in any capacity understands that those funds don't create equality of opportunity, but it's certainly worse without them. Don't necessarily trust states and localities to administer them fairly and without bias, given the track record historically of states and localities on these issues.
I mean, I don't disagree with you because of the amount of lawsuits that are filed and that are challenged as it relates to, you know, in the aftermath of the affirmative action ruling. And, you know, when we talk about the opportunity, that's one thing. But when we're talking about equity, that's a new frontier that's entirely different. And we're tying a lot of these dollars now from federal DOE to this equity notion, which is run violative of the U.S. Constitution in so many different ways that are being challenged in these cases. And a lot of universities, high schools, and others throughout the country are having to reverse course on a lot of the programs and policies that they're implementing because, you know, and interestingly, a lot of it started with these conditions that were tied to a lot of this money that the Fed was giving out. And we're seeing the same thing with student debt relief today. You know, and we're doing a piecemeal approach to this because those students that are going to Tulane, UNO, Delgado, wherever it may be, and borrowing money mm-hmm. today, there's no relief even talking about being handled for them. And in fact, almost every OIG report ever issued on the number one program of federal DOE, the FAFSA, has been negative. In fact, the most recent report was damning as it relates to their transition to the new application process.
Last year was an absolute disaster.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I hadn't talked to a single university official that thought any of that went well. And that's the largest program that they manage. But it seems as though they're off on the sidelines, you know, running amok with a whole bunch. And this is both Republicans and Democrats. No one has the corner on this debacle in my mind. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it seems like we're on the sidelines running amok with all of this, all of these other issues and not fulfilling the needs of their basic mission and vision of the organization. And any review that's done of this organization, I don't know if I hadn't found a real positive one yet. Maybe you have. I haven't.
Well, I think when you're talking about an organization as large as any of these federal agencies, you know, there's you'd have to talk about specific programs. And so when you talk about the FAFSA, you know, last year they rolled out a new application for federal student aid, and it was delayed and it had lots of glitches. And like you said, there's nobody out there that thinks that that went very well. Now, that program is completely separate from the programs that I'm talking about with regard to K-12 education.
Sure.
And neither of those, so the programs that I'm talking about with regard to Title I funding and IDEA funding, that's for disabled students, and FAFSA, none of that is tied to what you were talking about with regard to DEI. And I think that when Trump is talking about eliminating the Department of Education, you know, first, he's not the first Republican candidate to say that he's going to do this, right? I think Reagan said that he was going to do this like a year or two after the department was created. And, you know, here we are. So, but I think the differences are now, I think what Trump is talking about is these culture war issues, that this is a sort of symbolic issue that it's not necessarily, I don't hear from him that it is targeting government waste. You know, that is a common Republican belief that, you know, the federal government wastes a lot of money. We need to cut the size of the federal government in order to save money, right? But mostly when Trump is talking about this, it's around these kind of culture war issues. And so it's kind of a signal to his supporters of sort of where he stands on these issues, which I don't think anybody, you know, questions where he stands on those issues. But
not really the issue, is it? I mean, it's really the legitimacy of the whim of who we elect as president as to whether or not we're going to have a consistent way and fashion to educate our kids. And when we start tying some of these ideological notions to money, and it all depends on who's, you know, elected to the executive branch of government, I think it has a very disruptive force as to, you know, establishing some consistency. I mean, government moves slow. It's not very nimble. And if we have administration changes on 4-year cycles as opposed to 8-year cycles, it even gets more disruptive in what we're doing. And then when you add to it the toxicity that's out there today, we're seeing a disruption that we've never, ever seen before. Who's to blame is of no moment to me. It just seems like that fundamentally, structurally, something's got to change, because we cannot have these whims driving our educational policy in this country, because I don't think we're going to end up in a good place. I think we're going to end up worse off than we are now. Your thoughts?
Well, I wonder, I'd ask you a question about the issue of consistency. So do you think that schools across the United States should have a more consistent curriculum so that, you know, kids in Louisiana are, you know, they have a similar curriculum as kids in, you mentioned, Montana or Ohio or wherever?
I think when it comes to the basics, there ought to be certain things that are kind of sacrosanct, right? That, you know, in our approach, I'm one that kind of believes in a lot of the Montessori model, that, you know, we're doing things where we're not spending as much time having kids read and bringing them up to their grade level early on in their education. You know, because the data is so overwhelming as to the success of that. So I do believe that there should be some standardization. But as we move through and we get to high school and stuff like that, I think we should leave that more to the states than the federal government. I understand what you're saying about the amount of money, but they carry a big stick in more ways than one. And, you know, and I've seen this happen with FERPA and so many other things that just don't make sense, that stand in the way of local government and state government trying to address situations not only on school campuses, but school policy and curriculum and moving forward.
Yeah, I guess the reason that I asked was that, I think a lot of people agree with you that having more consistency around particularly early childhood and, you know, early secondary education is a good thing, so that we don't have big differences across the states. But then who would administer that and who would ensure that that's going to be in place? It can't be the individual states. Right, if we're going to have consistency. And so there's a tension there, right? There's a desire for local control and, you know, getting the federal government out of our education. But also wanting to have, you know, strict accountability where students are testing and we're holding schools accountable, and a consistent curriculum across all the states. And so, you know, if we're going to have those things, accountability and consistency, then, you know, there's going to need to be some kind of, that's the sort of purpose of the federal government. And so there's going to have to be some sort of federal authority.
I guess a hybrid model, right? Because there are basically 10 subcomponent agencies of the Department of Education. And the vast majority of it, I mean, you know this as well as I, that FAFSA and that taking up about 2/3 of the amount of funding that's out there from federal DOE, they outsource that. So they're not even managing it. You know, so
we have that, you know, I think we have that hybrid model right now where, you know, the vast majority of education spending is local and state, and the federal government has this sort of very small set of, you know, the small scope of authority and a pretty small budget.
But we get back to the whim of the politicization of, you know, we're going to give student debt relief. Oh, really? For who?
Mm-hmm.
A small segment of those that have incurred debt. And we're not modifying anything as it relates to the program moving forward, because that's going to be up to another administration,
I think that President Biden would agree with you there. And the issue, Trump wins the election and wants to eliminate the Department of Education, he will need Congress to be able to do that.
Sure.
And, you
sure.
know, if President Biden could, you know, and he tried to do more with executive action in terms of student loan relief and doing things. But presidents don't have all the authority, right? And that's
right.
That's our system. And so Congress would have to pass some changes to our current laws around student loans and how they're administered and who's eligible and relief and all of those things. So that's not within the scope of authority for the president, as is neither the elimination of the department. All of that would have to come out of Congress.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I actually don't believe it's achievable, but I like to talk about it for folks to think about what's being said and how this is being handled and what the outcomes are, you know, the upsides and the downsides to this. In the end, I think you would agree our outcomes need to be improved. And I just don't see anybody really meaningfully moving this thing in the right direction for us at the present time. Thank you so much for joining us,
Jay
Celeste Lay, Professor, Department of Political Science at Tulane University. Really enjoyed the conversation. Have a great week.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us.
For the past 3 seasons of Gone South, we've covered one story per season. Now, Gone South is back for a 4th season. But this time, we're doing things a little differently. In Gone South Season 4, we'll be bringing you new stories every week with no end in sight. Listen to and follow Gone South, an Odyssey original podcast, on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.